welcome to the kernel session. We have here a chap who's probably quite well known to you. He was quite well known by remote control to me for many years. This is Jonathan Corbett, who publishes Linux Strongly News and has been diving into the underbelly of the IT section for be a decade now, wouldn't it? And doing pretty well at surviving, given all the to and fro that happened a few years ago. And he's also a kernel developer, and he'll be telling us something about how the kernel works. This is a kernel report, and as far as I'm concerned, that's what happens when you drop the kernel and it goes bang on the floor. But anyway, he'll actually be telling us something that we can use, something that we can take home about how the kernel works and where it's going. So, attention time.
Well, thank you. It is working. Do you hear me? Good enough. All right, well, I'm John, here to talk about the kernel. This is a talk I've been doing for some years now. Fortunately for you, I actually update it between presentations. And hopefully it is current to the current state of affairs, although Linus is off in some room somewhere trying to outdate me as I talk. This is a two-part talk. I'll start first talking about the process, the development process, and what the status of that is. Then I'll move on to the sort of hand-waving, thinking about what's going to happen in the future part later on in the talk. We'll start with what is perhaps the briefest, most concise history of kernel development you've ever seen. Starting way back at the beginning, you can see the history of major releases over the course of about the first 12 years. There are a few patterns that jump out of here, including a release period that started roughly around a year and then tended to grow until you got to the period between 2.2, 2.4, 2.6, where you were getting up to periods of almost 3 years between releases, which was not a good state of affairs. In fact, if you were a kernel developer and you actually observed the feature freezes in some of these periods, you could wait on the order of 3-4 years or so before the work that you did actually made it through into a published, stable, mainline kernel release, which was rather frustrating for a lot of people, users and developers both, which led to the situation where distributors were backporting a lot of patches into their alleged stable kernels. And it was generally a messy situation that people didn't like. Towards the end of this period that you see here, in a lot of ways, the development process looked to be in a bit of a crisis period. It was really bogging down in a bad way. If you look more recently, though, what you see is a very different pattern. This is a set of major kernel releases. Every one of these is a major release with new features, API breakage, all that good stuff that you expect from a shiny new mainstream kernel, right? And they're coming in a very regular sort of way at this point, about every 2 to 3 months. In fact, we can now make a prediction. And I would actually be willing to bet something reasonably valuable on this prediction that sometime in April, we will see the 2.6.25 kernel. It didn't used to be that way, but now it really is. The process has changed quite a bit. And as we will see, what's going on with this process is really pretty impressive. If you just sort of focus on the period between two releases, say 2.6.24, which is the current kernel as of a few days ago, and 2.6.25, which I have said is coming out sometime April-ish. What you'll see between two releases like that is a whole set of internal development releases that all have this dash RC tag on them. They are not actually release candidates, at least most of them are not, but that's just the nomenclature that's used because Linus just doesn't want to say, okay, I think now it's ready to call it a release tag or a release candidate. So that's who they are. So you see these RC1, RC2, RC whatever releases. 2.6.24 went up to 2.6.24 RC8. That came out before the actual final release came out. The way this actually works within the process is that the first 2 weeks of any given kernel development cycle is a period that is called the merge window. This is when all of the new features and API breakages and all the other good stuff that you're expecting to see in the next kernel development cycle is supposed to go in all over the course of about 2 weeks. During that time, the patch flow into the mainline kernel is amazing. If you watch this, it can be usually at least 5,000 individual change sets and often quite a bit more than that will happen during this 2-week period. We are, in fact, in that period right now. The merge window opened just before the conference started. There have been, as of this morning, about 4,000 patches merged. I think Lena's pulled in about 2,000 of them after the speaker dinner last night, which strikes me as distinctly hazardous. But but he did it. So sometime, probably about a week and a half from now, maybe just a little bit longer, because the conference is going to stretch out this merge window a little bit. But within about 2 weeks from now, that merge window will close, and you'll see the 2625-RC1 kernel go out. At that point, the kernel is feature complete, at least in theory, it is feature complete, and the process will dedicate itself entirely to stabilization at that point. And only things which are fixing problems can go in after that. Now, what's considered a fix can be a little bit loose at times, but the discipline is actually pretty good anymore, if you look at the way this works now. This is a chart I originally ripped off from Andrew Morton and then redid it myself over time. This is a plot of cumulative lines changed in the kernel code base over time. So it's just a count of how many lines of code have been changed as time goes on, starting at the very beginning of the Git repository, sort of the current era of kernel development, in a sense. So if you look at it, you can see a few things that jump out at you. One of them, especially in more recent times, is the stair-step pattern that comes out. You see the line go almost vertical during the merge window, when all this code goes into the main line. And then the merge window closes and it levels out very quickly. It took a while to get there. The merge window policy was actually adopted during the 2005 kernel summit. It was adopted right about this time. But it took a few releases to really get that discipline into place and make it work right and really build the expectation in the kernel development community that this merge window would be respected. But it really is pretty strongly respected now, and it works quite well. The other thing that I like to point out, a couple years ago now, Andrew Morton said that he really thought that this line would level out at some point, because, as he put it, we really have to finish this project at some time. As far as anybody can tell, there is no leveling out really in prospect anytime soon. If anything, it almost looks like things are taking off. The 2624 cycle, which is that last jump that you see there, was in some ways, I mean, perhaps the biggest certainly in recent history with the kernel. The amount of stuff that went into 2624 was pretty mind-boggling, and 2625 maybe a bit less, but there's going to be a lot going on there as well. Just a couple more numbers here. I looked at what happened over the course of 2007, which is essentially from the 2620RC3 kernel through to 2624RC7. During that time, just over 30,000 individual change sets were merged into the kernel, right? Individual changes. These changed over 2 million lines of code, adding about 750,000 lines. If you just do the math, we are adding, not even thinking about changing, just adding about 2,000 lines of code to the kernel every single day of the year, without exception. Nobody can really keep up with this anymore. It's an amazing process, but it seems to be working pretty well. There are questions about who does this work. I've spent some time looking at this. One answer is this sort of motley crowd that you see up here. This is taken at the 2007 Kernel Developer Summit in Cambridge back in September. So you see perhaps the top roughly 70 people who are part of this. But this view of the development process is really kind of misleading. If you look at what's really going on, again, looking at what happened over the course of 2007, there were nearly 2,000 developers who contributed to the kernel. 2,000 individual people who got patches into there. Several hundred of those, forget the number, about 700 of those contributed a single patch. They found one thing that they could fix, they fixed it, and then went on doing whatever it is they normally do. Everybody else did more than that. These developers represented 200 separate companies. This is perhaps one of the largest examples of corporate collaboration that we've ever seen out there. 200 companies are all cooperating, building this one common resource that they are all making use of. Of all these developers, back to developers now, only 11 of them contributed at least 1% of the total. If you look back 10 years ago, something like that, the top 20 or so developers contributed by far the majority of the changes that went into the kernel. That has broadened considerably now, to the point that only 11 contribute more than 1%. Nobody in this, over the course of this year, contributed 2% of the total set of patches there. I just put up the top five there for the heck of it. People who are contributing at least one patch a day, every day, all year round, and somehow managing to live a life anyway. And that's a view of where we're at with this. Who do they work for? I was very curious about this starting about a year ago. Realized that I could do some data mining on the kernel repository, do a lot of work trying to assign developers to the people they work for, which is not an easy thing to do. This has been a fairly long-term effort done by me and Greg Crowe-Hartman has also worked on this stuff. What we found is that we could identify 17% of the kernel contributors who had no employer as such, who were working on their own time to do this work. Okay, there was about 10% we couldn't really identify at all. Everybody else had a corporate affiliation that we could reasonably solidly identify for their work. And so you see who's involved in creating the kernels that we all use, with Red Hat and IBM up at the top, various other companies up there. You see a lot of companies sort of in the middle, a lot of hardware companies working in that area. And you see, well, you actually don't see a lot of embedded companies down towards the bottom. Most of them are down there. But that's where we are in terms of what's going into the kernel and who is sponsoring this. The vision or the picture that people once portrayed of the kernel as being the product of volunteers and kids or people who are not no longer kids living in their parents' basement cranking out the stuff is really not the case anymore. Even if you assign the whole 10% unknowns to the people who are working on their own time, we're still at well over 2/3 of the kernel being developed by people who are being paid to do that work. So that's kind of my view of the process, where I get to kind of move on and wave my hands and make some guesses as to what's coming from here. The usual disclaimers apply at a time like this because I don't really have any special view into the kernel process that anybody else doesn't have. I have no privileged information here. I certainly don't have a 5-year roadmap that I could read that will tell me what's going on with this. All right, so I just look at what's going on, read the list, see what the pressures are, and kind of make my best guesses. So don't really count on much that I'm telling you here. And expect things that will come completely out of the blue. Expect surprises. This is really one of the funnest part of this whole thing, is that there will be something that will show up that will just surprise everybody, and nobody will have seen it coming. And there will be no manager out there saying, well, that's not part of our roadmap, you can't do that. It's one of the best parts of the whole thing. So, the easiest predictions usually are for the next kernel. It's harder now because we're less than halfway into the merge window, and so we haven't really seen what's going to go in there yet. So what I've listed here is just a few things that have gone in so far. Everything that's on this list is already merged. There's a whole big pile of stuff, probably more stuff than this, which is still waiting on the wings and has yet to go in. And I'm not going to make too many guesses as to what that will be. So there's a big update to the low-level device model code, which won't affect most people except that a lot of drivers broke. Most of that stuff has been fixed. Real-time group scheduling, I'll get back to that in a little bit, as well as dynamic tick stuff, which is also something I'll come back to. Latency top is an interesting feature that just kind of actually appeared out of the blue fairly recently, came out of Intel. It's a tool for measuring latency within the system and finding out why it is that programs are not responding perhaps as quickly as you might like. We'll see another example where a tool like this has really changed things. It's really true that as soon as you can see into the system and see where the problems are, they tend to get fixed very quickly. So I'm really kind of interested to see what will come out once this latency top tool starts to be shipped by the distributors and people start using it and finding out why things aren't working the way they are expected to work. There's a lot of ext4 stuff, which I will come back to. A whole lot of networking patches. That's a lot of what went in last night was stuff from the networking tree. So a lot of IPv6 work. If you want to learn more about that, I think there's a talk in the next session on the IPv6 stuff, a lot of IPsec stuff, things like that. Controller area networks, sort of this very robust local area network, the sort of network that you would put in an automobile, for example, to have all of your your forward sensing radar and your telephone and all this stuff sort of talk to each other. This is an interesting patch set. It came out of Volkswagen, which is not normally what you consider to be a hotbed of kernel development. But But they saw it in their interest to develop this code, and more to the point, to get it to the point where it was suitable for inclusion in the mainline kernel and useful for everybody. So as of 2.6.25, we'll have control area network support in the kernel, and perhaps in an automobile near you sometime soon. Don't try to patch it while you're driving, please. And network namespace support, I will come back to that as well. So that's a view of what's gone in so far. Like I said, this process has just begun. So if you're curious, watch LWN over the next couple of weeks, and we'll see what else gets merged and what we'll really expect from this kernel that's coming out in April. So now getting more general, an area of continual effort is scalability. It's an area of occasional debate because people will say, you've got all these scalability people who are working really hard to make the kernel run optimally on these monster big iron machines that these big companies sell, and this is really going to mess things up for all the rest of us who just have normal computers. My answer to this really is always to go back to one of the first scalability discussions that I watched closely, which is actually about 10 years ago now. I stumbled across it again. It had to do with what was required to get a 32-bit system to support more than 1 gigabyte of memory, which is something that Linux could not do 10 years ago. You could not do that on a normal 32-bit system. Linus was saying that you will never be able to. He said that if you wanted that, you need to buy a 64-bit system. He said it was not negotiable. I am sure now that there are dozens of machines in this room which have more memory than that in them and are running in 32-bit modes, which is why I like to say that today's supercomputer is tomorrow's laptop. The scalability work that you see going on now will eventually be quite useful for the machines that you'll be running in the future. So even if you don't see yourself running some monster high-performance computing system, this work is of interest to you. So if you wonder what's going on at the leading edge now, there are companies that are actually selling 1024 processors, single system image systems out there. They work pretty well, at least for certain kinds of loads. If you're doing high-performance scientific computing stuff and so on, you can do very well with systems like this. My understanding is if you're trying to do some sort of transactional database type thing, then maybe you won't quite get the results you want still. But there are people working on that. There are people working on scaling this bigger, getting up to 4K processors. And it's always the same sort of stuff of trying to eliminate data structures that explode as the system gets bigger, dealing with highly contended locks that slow things down. All the usual scalability work that has to be done is still going on and will continue to be as these systems get bigger. Scalability, though, is a two-ended spectrum here. If you only go up to really big systems, you're not truly scalable, you're just big. So you have to be able to scale down to the small end as well. And as I'm sure everybody knows, there's a great deal of interest in using Linux on very small systems, being cell phones or OLPC systems or any number of smaller systems that really just don't want to see a lot of resource use. So there's a continual effort on this side too. This one is a bit harder to see sometimes because a lot of the people working in this area, embedded systems companies and so on, are not always very good about giving their changes back into the mainline kernel. This is something I'll get back to. It's an ongoing problem. I think it's getting better. But the simple fact is that a lot of the people working in this area are not participating in the process, and so the work that they're doing is not really reflected in the mainline and does not benefit anybody into the future. And that's kind of a sad situation. But it is being done, and Linux does scale down pretty well if you work at it hard enough. A very different sort of scalability issue comes up in the file systems area, which has become an area of a great deal of interest in the last few years as people have realized that the file systems we have now really are not going to be adequate for the demands that are going to be facing us in the coming years. And this can be a problem especially because file system developers tend to be very conservative people, simply being that the failure mode for file systems is really kind of unpleasant. And file system developers really want to be able to come to an event like this and survive. So they take a long time to say, this stuff is really ready for you to use. You can trust your data to it. So to a great extent, the file system work that you want to be using 5 years from now really has to be underway now. one of the big things that's happening, of course, in this area is that disk drives are getting bigger all the time. It's always sort of amusing to go to the computer store and just see what you can buy for how cheap now. They're not getting better, and they're in particular not really getting faster, with the result that the time it takes to read through a whole drive, a single drive, has grown tremendously over the last years. And this is really a problem, especially when you say, come down here and you say, I'm going to do a presentation, boot my system, file system check time. And you realize that now you've got that big disk in your laptop and you're going to be spending the next half an hour doing a file system check when you're supposed to be talking. Now, if you've got a really big file system on some sort of critical system somewhere, this file system check time can stretch into something going from hours to days or more. And this is really a problem, and it's just going to bite us worse and worse as these disk drives get bigger. So there are a lot of people looking at ways of making file system checking go faster. Unfortunately, the talk on that is happening right now, so you all don't get to hear it unless you run over right now. But there's some other work going on. One is a general area called ChunkFS or TileFS. This is being done mostly by Val Hansen at the moment. She'll be talking about it later on. So I had to give her some grief because she said that the code would be available in August and bootable now. So ask her to demonstrate that for you. But the core idea is good. The idea is that you take a file system, you simply subdivide it into a whole bunch of smaller subfile systems, each of which has its own clean or dirty state. So if something happens, somebody pulls the plug, and the file system has to be checked, you only really have to check the portions of it which were under use at the time. So that will cut your file system check time significantly. It's a simple idea, but there's a lot of complications when you get into actually implementing it, such as what happens when one of these subfile systems runs out of space, but a file within it wants to grow. So you have to split the file across these internal file systems and so on. So it's a lot trickier than you might think. There's a lot that has to be done. You won't ever see, I don't think, a separate file system called ChunkFS. What you're going to see is this kind of concept merged into existing file systems, just as a way of speeding up file system checking on those systems. So again, go to Val's talk if you want to learn more about this. It should be good stuff. Another interesting area of development, this is something that came out of the blue less than a year ago now, called ButterFS. This is being done by Chris Mason. This is a brand new file system, kind of starting from the beginning. So it's got all of the cool stuff that we want to see in file systems now. It's extent-based. This differentiates it from a lot of the file systems we're using now, which are based on block pointers. If you've got a file in an ext3 file system, there's a list in there somewhere that says it has that block, which is over here, and then that block, which is over there, or that block, which is over there. If you have a big file, you have a very long list of block pointers and a fairly complicated data structure just keeping track of all these block pointers. If you've ever wondered why it takes a long time to delete a very big file, it's because it's going through and cleaning up this entire structure of block pointers all over the disk. That also, by the way, costs you a lot in file system checking time, because you have to actually go and find all those block pointers. Extents, instead, simply say, rather than this block, that block, that block, say, I've got a group of this many blocks over here, there's this many blocks over there. It's a more compact and natural way to store things, especially if you've got bigger files, which is the way things are anymore. Originally, Unix file systems were oriented around very small files, but that's just not what we have anymore. We have lots of big ones. So ButterFS is extent-based, like any file system would be that's being developed now. It has some nice features for subvolume, splitting a file system into logical file systems within it. Snapshotting, you can actually take a quick snapshot of the file system at any time while it's running. There's a lot of very useful things you can do with it. One simple example would be just doing backups on a live file system. You take a snapshot and you've got a consistent version of the file system that you can back up while the file system is still under use. There's a lot of other things, keeping history, you can do with it. The snapshotting is so good and so fast that ButterFS actually does not do journaling. It uses the snapshotting as its internal transaction mechanism. It just takes a snapshot, makes all of its changes to the file system, and then moves that snapshot forward to the current state of affairs. It's got checksumming on all data and metadata within the file system, which is a good thing. Modern disk drives are not as reliable as we would always like them to be. It's designed for online file system checking, so that you can check a live file system that is not yet working. And it's also designed for offline file system checking to be very fast. The idea being that you can check a ButterFS file system by reading sequentially through the disk rather than having to seek all over it. In fact, seek optimization is an important feature of ButterFS in general. I just ripped off a chart here, or a plot from Chris Mason that he posted. So if you look at the first one, you're looking at head position for a very important operation to kernel developers. He was copying kernel trees. You can see that green mess is ext3 seeking its disk head all over the place. You can't really even see the ButterFS one that isn't going anywhere. But if you look at the middle plot, you can just see the seek counts there. And so ButterFS, being that red plot, is doing very little seeking to carry out these operations. And in fact, the plot ends much sooner than the others do because it was that much quicker at doing these copy operations. So there's a lot of very interesting stuff that's coming out of this. This may well be the file system that we'll be using in the future. But it's still quite new. It's probably going to be another year before it's reached a point where he considers it to be mostly feature complete. And then there's the point of actually getting confident enough in it that you can actually use it for stuff that you care about. Meanwhile, we all run this file system called ext3, or most of us do. The successor to that is a thing called ext4, which is in the kernel now, marked as a developmental thing. You have to kind of ask very hard and promise that you know what you're doing before you can actually make use of this. But it's there. It includes a lot of useful things, 48-bit block numbers, things like that, that got rid of the initial file system size limit, which was 16 terabytes, which was already getting to the point where it would cramp the style of certain kinds of users, you know, like my kids with their downloading stuff. But so they've expanded that limit. In fact, they've expanded it further to the point that as of 2.6.25, there's no practical limit for the near future anyway on file system size. It's extent-based, of course. It's got nanosecond timestamps so that you can run your make on your super fast system, and the whole thing completes in a tenth of a second, and it will still get all the file modification times right. Things like delayed allocation, which is a way of optimizing block layout, that's something that's going in. Actually, delayed allocation isn't quite there yet, but a lot of the precursor stuff is. Journal checksums are going in for 2.6.25. As is the large file supports, and then you can have very big files on an ext3 file system, should you want to do so. Online defragmentation is something that's further out. I'm not quite sure when that will be ready. It's coming. The ext4 developers think that as of 2.6.25, all of the work that will require on-disk format changes is done. So that's kind of an important milestone with the development of this file system. There will be no more on-disk format changes. That's kind of the first step towards stabilizing the whole thing and getting it to where it's going to be useful. So I wouldn't say 2008, certainly, but maybe 2009, ext4 will be getting closer to where people want to make use of it. We will see. Meanwhile, other people are saying, well, all of this optimization that goes on for rotating storage is a good thing. We can use it for a while. But the real future is in solid-state storage. As these flash devices get bigger and bigger, what we need is a file system that will work very well with large flash devices. We don't really have that now in the kernel. We have a thing called JFFS2, which works on smaller media, but it has to do things like actually reconstruct the entire directory tree at mount time. That's the way a lot of these earlier flash file systems worked, so that as the device gets bigger, the time to mount a file system grows to the point where it can take minutes, which is not really what you want to just do a mount. So there are a couple of efforts out there to create a successor to JFFS2. The most prominent one perhaps being LogFS. That's being worked on by Jorn Engel, who is here somewhere. I don't know if he's in the room, but he's at the conference. So it has a lot of interesting features, including putting the directory tree on the media so you don't have to reconstruct it at mount time. It's got this interesting wandering tree log structure, which allows it to do the sort of wear leveling that you have to do on flash file systems, and do it at a journal once again, just by sort of incrementally updating the tree as you make changes to the file system. So it's intended to perform very well on flash file systems and so on. This work is currently being sponsored by the Consumer Electronics Linux Forum. So I'm expecting to see some things happen with this in the near future. There's another development out there called UBIFS. People are working on a separate flash file system, and I haven't had the time to really learn what's going on with that yet. But that is another contender out there for flash file systems in the future. So there will come a time when we'll be using this stuff, because at some point, solid-state storage will be big enough that who would need more space than that? And then just something I thought I would mention in the area of remote file systems is not a whole lot that's happened in a few years, but Zach Brown is working on a thing called the Coherent Remote File System. This is based on top of ButterFS if you want it to really work very well. And he'll be talking about this on Friday, I think. So if you want to know more about the future of remote file systems, I suggest going to that talk. I'll be there and learning about it with you. So that's pretty much what I had to say on file systems. Once upon a time, I had a whole bunch of slides on virtualization. But at this point, we have three options in the kernel, being Xen, LGuest, and KVM. There are talks here on two of those, LGuest and KVM, for those who are interested in that. Most of the work in this area is done. It's a matter of tying up the loose ends and fixing the performance and bringing in some other architectures is perhaps the biggest thing that still needs to be done with virtualization. But to a great extent, virtualization is a solved problem now, at least at the kernel level. So there's less happening now, and we can stop talking about it so much, which is a really nice thing. At user space level, there's a lot that has to be done, and this is where all these virtualization companies will be competing with each other, is creating management interfaces that makes all this stuff work and so on. And there's a lot to be done in that area, but that's user space. Okay, the other side of virtualization, though, is a thing called containers. And this is a place where there's still a lot of work going on. Containers can be thought of as a sort of lightweight virtualization mechanism. Full virtualization, like the options we talked about in the last slide, run each guest in its own virtual machine. Each guest is running its own kernel. In fact, can be running a different operating system than the host is. With containers, instead, what you're really doing is just drawing walls around groups of processes on the same kernel. So containerized systems all share the same host kernel. A big difference there. It reduces your flexibility in that you can't be running different operating systems anymore. But it gives you back a lot in the performance area, to the point that you can often run many times more containerized systems on the same host as virtualized systems. So there's a lot of projects working in this area. The supporting containers turns out to be a lot harder than supporting full virtualization in a lot of ways, because rather than just creating this virtual machine that something is isolated within, you have to go through the entire kernel code base and find every shared resource that is out there and put a layer of indirection around it so that it becomes a container-specific sort of thing. So global resources on a Linux system include the list of processes that are running out there, the devices that are available, file systems that are available. Even the system time is, in fact, a global resource that, in a containerized system, you want to be able to draw a wall around and let each container have its own idea of time. So this is a fair amount of very intrusive work that's going on to make containers work in the kernel. Then you got to add resource management, that sort of stuff. It's a lot of work. It's taken a long time. The biggest problem for a while was that there were several projects wanting to do this, and they each had their own way of isolating system resources. And getting one of them in is a very hard sell, because people don't want to deal with all this container stuff if they're not actually using it. They don't want to see it impact the performance of the system. Bringing in half a dozen of them was just never going to fly. So all of these projects were told a few years ago that they have to go off and work together and come up with a single set of interfaces that they can all use. And in fact, they've been doing that pretty effectively. And a lot of stuff has gone into the kernel. Some of the stuff that's still happening right now includes process ID namespaces. This is a feature that went in 2.6.24 of just giving each container its own view of the list of processes running on the system. But there's a lot of rather thorny issues around this that are still being resolved on that. So this isn't really a usable feature quite yet. Network namespaces is a very complicated thing of containerizing the entire networking stack. So there's a lot of stuff for that going in 2.6.25, and the job still isn't entirely done, although it's getting a lot closer to it at that point. There's overall control. Control groups feature has gone into the kernel but isn't being used yet for a lot of stuff. So there's a lot of work to be done in this area. So, you know, it's going to be another year before I can put up a slide and say containers too are a solved problem. Maybe even longer than that. But they're working on it. Okay, something totally different. CPU scheduling. I mean, it seemed like a solved problem to the point that I went and I looked at the talk I gave here a year ago on all this stuff, and I had no slides on scheduling at all. None at all. Because there was really, it seemed like there was nothing going on. And then out of the blue came a thing called the staircase deadline scheduler, which sort of changed the whole view of how scheduling should be done. The older Linux scheduler performed well in a lot of situations, but a lot of work had been put into it trying to make it work well in interactive situations. And this involved a great deal of heuristic code saying, is this process behaving this way? Okay, is it interactive? Should we boost its priority? No, it's not interactive. Let's penalize it. And people worked and worked on these heuristics trying to make all this stuff go to the point that the scheduler became kind of a twisted hairball of heuristics. It was very hard to read the scheduler code. And to top it off, it still wasn't really doing interactive response the way people wanted it to do. The idea behind the staircase deadline scheduler was done actually by an Australian named Con Kalivas, was just throw away all of that stuff and instead enforce a very simple fairness regime on all the processes running on the system. If you have five processes in the run queue at the same priority, each one of those processes will get 20% of the processor, period. Be done with that. So it simplified things immensely and, in fact, produced better interactive response, too, while they're at it, at least in most situations. So it really seemed like the way to go. As it turned out, though, this staircase deadline scheduler did not make it into the kernel for something they could give a whole talk on in its own right. It was a long story. What went in instead is a thing called the completely fair scheduler, which is a re-implementation of the same idea that was done by Ingo Molnar. So once again, we've dumped all the interactivity stuff and replaced it with something much simpler. This code first went in 2.6.23. It's actually getting to be a bit of an old story. Group scheduling was added in 2.6.24. This just enhanced the fairness idea so that instead of having processes contend against each other for the CPU, you now have groups of processes. So these groups of processes can be all the processes owned by one user, all the processes owned by another user, so that you can have users getting fair scheduling rather than just individual processes. Or you can do things like make kernel compilers go very fast and penalize web browsers, or you can do anything like that. With the group scheduling feature. It's a very flexible and interesting feature. So that went in 2.6.24. It's being enhanced further in 2.6.25 with real-time features so you can do real-time type scheduling as well. So that work is still going on in that area. A related scheduler issue is Syslets, which is an interesting idea. It was originally aimed at the problem of asynchronous I.O., which has always been rather poorly supported in the Linux world. The idea behind a syslet is that a process can call into the kernel if the thing it's asking the kernel to do, say read from a file, would make that process wait. The kernel actually creates a new thread, returns the user space in that new thread, so the user space can continue to do whatever it was doing while the original system call sits there and waits until whatever it's waiting for becomes available. Then it completes on its own time, and then at some point in the future, the process can collect the results and figure out what happened. It's an interesting feature. I think this will eventually get in, but there's a whole lot of details that have to be worked out in just how this is going to work. And it seems to be going slow, so I wouldn't hazard to guess as to when you'll see that. Real-time is sort of the other scheduling issue that we talk about. This is hard real-time, actually trying to support deterministic response times in a general purpose kernel, something a lot of people have said could never be done. They've made a lot of progress towards this goal. A lot of the work that has been done in this area has already been merged in the kernel. A lot of the stuff that went in and past kernels is now there. There's a few things that are left to go in. This includes finishing out the dynamic tick functionality, which is getting closer with 2.6.25, of getting rid of the periodic clock tick and instead going to a dynamic clock that can give you much higher resolution, which is something that you need for real-time response. Dynamic tick is useful for a lot of other things as well, including power savings and so on. But the real-time work is driving a lot of this stuff. Sleeping spin locks is very controversial, low-level mutual exclusion stuff that will take a while to get in, I would guess, but may eventually. Interrupt handlers and threads is another aspect of this work, simply taking interrupt handlers and training them into processes so they, too, can be scheduled and preempted and will not create latencies if you're trying to respond quickly to something else. I had thought some of that would go into 2.6.25, but that doesn't seem to have happened. So maybe in 2.6.26, we'll start to see some more of the real-time work going into the mainline kernel. Okay, a few system calls. I'll just touch on these quickly. Things that people are working on. Revoke is The idea behind revoke is that you open some sort of a file, perhaps a device file, and you call revoke, and anybody else who has that thing open now gets their access to it terminated. It's a security sort of feature. You can think of it as being able to log into the console, for example, and make sure that nobody else has the sound device open, things like that. Revoke turns out to be really hard to do in a safe sort of way. So this work has taken a long time, and I don't know when that's going to come around. Indirect is a way of kind of kludging additional parameters onto existing system calls. There's some pressure for that. I think that may not succeed. Hijack is a container sort of thing where you can actually create a new process like fork or clone would do, but it starts that process in the context of a different one. This is a way of entering an existing container and doing things within the environment of that container. That one I think needs some work, but you'll see that come around at some point. Sort of new ways of talking to the kernel. Okay, hardware issues, talked about very quickly. Hardware issues have been an area of problems for years. Wireless networking being one of the biggest ones. A lot of work has been done in this area. There's a new wireless stack that has been merged and slowly beaten into shape. Drivers have been slower, but they're coming around. Regulatory compliance issues, I don't know how or when those will get resolved in terms of how do you drive a wireless device in a way that complies with whatever rules apply in the jurisdiction you're running in at the time. We've got good support now for a lot of adapters. The biggest problem area for a while now has been Etheros drivers. And so I'm really happy to say that the AF5K driver, which will solve this problem, has been merged now for 2.6.25. So as of 2.6.25, most wireless adapters will be supported with native free Linux drivers. And I think that's a good thing. Okay, on a related issue, video drivers have been perhaps the biggest problem area here. Intel, of course, supports all of its video hardware with free drivers really from the time they launch it. They do a really great job that way, something that I think has been a great thing. ATI has been a little bit slower, but it has come around and is now releasing documentation and so on. So ATI, while their newer chipsets aren't really supported yet, they will be within a year and so on. NVIDIA, of course, remains completely uncooperative in this area. There's a reverse engineering effort that's going on that. I haven't really checked in with them recently to see where they're at with that, but it's coming along. So I used to have a whole bunch of slides on closed source drivers. I don't really have them anymore. I've been to talks where I've seen people say that closed source drivers are immoral. I've seen people say that they're illegal. I went to a talk where a guy stood up and said, well, it may not be either of those, but they're simply bloody stupid, was the way he put it. I would like to submit that at this point, closed source drivers are irrelevant and unnecessary. And I think this is a great state of affairs. Okay, power management. One other hardware hassle that comes around, and really is hardware stuff. A lot of user space issues, but things are getting better again. Dynamic tick work has helped a lot. Fixing drivers. And a tool called PowerTalk, which if you haven't messed with, you really should mess with. This is something that came out of Intel. You run it on your laptop and it will tell you what it is that's waking up your system and making it consume power. Since PowerTalk came out, a vast number of power consumption bugs have been fixed on a lot of distributions, and you can just see the power usage of contemporary distributions falling down. It's been a great thing. Okay, about the last thing I have to talk about is tracing. Because there are certain vendors out there beating up on Linux because it doesn't have the same sort of tracing features that they have. And there's some truth to it. What we do have is a thing called SystemTap. As far as I can tell, SystemTap can actually do everything that dtrace can do in terms of hooking into a running kernel and bringing out information and filtering it and so on. In fact, it can even do things that dtrace cannot do. But it's really painful to use. If you're not a kernel developer, you have a hard time using SystemTap. So it's not really there for the people running, you know, operational environments. So we don't yet really have an answer to that until the sort of user space and management side of that has been addressed. There's another tracing toolkit called LTTNG. That'll be there someday. It's been out there for a long time. There's a renewed push to get that in the kernel, and I'm not quite sure what will happen with that. There's a lot of work happening in tracing and instrumentation. It's coming around, and I think we'll see a lot of progress on this over the course of the next year. Security, I don't have a lot to say about security. SE Linux has been out there for a while. The default solution is quite complex, as people know, but it's also quite secure in a lot of environments. There are a lot of other efforts out there, including a thing called AppArmor, which is supported mainly by Novell, although supported rather less by them than it used to be. There is a thing called SMAC, which is a simplified mandatory access control sort of kernel. Casey is actually here, we'll be talking about that soon. So if you're interested in that, I think that should be a very interesting talk to see. And there's an effort called Tomoyo Linux, which is out there, which looks a lot like AppArmor. Seems to be of interest in the embedded world, and I'm not really sure what's going to happen with that. AppArmor hasn't managed to get in, and it's kind of first in line in that area, so I don't know what the future would be of that. And there are various other efforts out there, but these are kind of the biggest ones happening in the security area. Okay, last thing I really want to talk about was participation. I don't need to get into this very much. The system works best when everybody helps in it, but it's really hard for some companies, especially in the embedded area, because they just don't see the benefits to them of doing that. But we're working on it, talking to these companies, and some of them are starting to come around. The other thing that we find is it's very hard for people in certain parts of the world, certain cultures. Working in English can be very hard if that's not your native language, of course. Very intimidating for some people to do. And very different modes of interactions. There are a lot of parts of the world where if you post a patch and somebody says, "You moron, why did you post this crap? We will never merge this," then you've not only suffered an attack, but you've shamed yourself in the view of your employer and your company and perhaps jeopardized your career. And this is really hard for people to deal with, and it's a matter of working on one end to get people to understand how the process works, and on the other end to get people to be nicer. In between the two, that's we're getting there. We're working on it. And then the very last slide is GPLv3. I think all I really need to say is don't expect it for the kernel anytime soon. Ask me if you have questions on that. And I'm done. So if there are questions, I think we should have a moment or two for questions.
Too much information. So, of course, we have about 5 or 6 minutes for questions. Ask good ones.
There was a question there. Do I have an idea of how many person hours go into the kernel every year? No. You
can't measure it.
You really can't. You can look at the patch flow and then apply whatever kind of magic constants you want to apply to that and try to come up with something. But yeah, it's large, right? But beyond that, I couldn't tell you. I wouldn't even want to. That's too much hand-waving even for me. Yes.
You were talking about the light patches coming in. Do you see any of the Linus does not scale
problems? Do I see any of the Linus does not scale issues coming up soon? This has been a real problem in the past where Linus just couldn't keep up with the patch flow and things fell on the floor and the whole process just fell apart from time to time. No, I don't see that. Linus at this point seems to be living a pretty easy life to where he can go off and flame people on the Git list instead. the process is working very well in that regard. I think we're starting to see some Andrew Morton doesn't scale issues. And that's perhaps a little bit more worrisome. And we will see. I think we'll work around that too. But something's going to have to happen there because he's having a hard time. He does a lot of the integration work and he's having a hard time keeping up with that sometimes. Researching cloning, yeah, there's sort of the Andrew Cox gnomes method, but that seems to be a hard one to reproduce. There was a question here and then.
There was a slide about the spread of various companies. Is that based on number of chain sets or
lines? I did the analysis both ways. You can look on LW and to see that. It was change sets was the one that I put up. It was just in terms of how many change sets went in. So, Grant?
So you mentioned file system logfs and how the file system is very hard to watch this to be needed. So there's already vendors selling laptops with solid-state systems, and the logfs automatically take care of where it was logfs, but they're not rotational media. They're definitely very different. And can those disks also have multiple IOs at the same time, but they're subject to sort of support going into them. So is there anybody working on other file systems for types of media?
Are there other
the embedded market is
Are there other people working on new file systems to address all the state storage devices? I think LogFS and UBIFS are the biggest ones that I know. You know, and that does go beyond just the embedded area. It's obviously going to have to scale beyond just embedded systems, right? I mean, the future there is pretty clear. There's a lot of work going on. There's a lot of very interesting issues because, of course, you really want to get below the translation layer and do the wear leveling yourself, which is what a lot of the real flash-oriented file systems do, is get around that sort of thing and manage the flash at the flash level, which is what you want to be able to do. Is the number of drivers submitted upstream relative to those out of tree changing? That's a hard one to answer. I think it is, because there's an increasing effort to get drivers into the tree. And beyond that, maintaining a driver out of tree is really an exercise in extreme masochism, because it's a moving target in a big way. And you're just always having to work to just keep this thing building and running. So there's a real incentive to get stuff in the tree. There are things like the Linux Driver Project, which is looking at some of the big out-of-tree drivers that are still remaining and looking at what could be done to get them in the tree. So there's a lot of work going on in that area, and I think that the balance is tipping that way. But you'll never get them all.
The time has come, the Laura said, to speak of many things, of sailing ships and sealing wax and kernel patches and things. And Jonathan's time is basically up, so if you didn't ask a good question, well, learn. Thank you for listening so carefully, and thank you, Jonathan, for all your info.